The submission is based on some research that has been conducted by the Children's Institute and the Center for Actuarial Research at UPT. So what we did is we combined a lawyer plus a political scientist and an economist, and we applied our minds to give you a legal argument around the must and the mays. What difference it makes to the budgeting process whether you use the word must for a service in the bill or the word may. So the first thing we did was to compare the budget that is needed for implementing the children's bill as estimated in the costing report. We compared it to the budget that's actually been allocated by government over the medium-term expenditure framework, which runs until 2010. And the research showed that actual budget allocations are falling very short of what is needed. Now, if you're familiar with the costing report, you'll know there's four scenarios that they project there. Okay? There's the implementation plan, which is based on actual service delivery. Now, we know that the levels of service delivery for children's social services is very low at the moment and way underneath the obligations that we're actually supposed to be doing under the Child Care Act. So those implementation plan estimates are very low. Then you get the full cost scenarios, which are based on actual needs. So that's based on the numbers of children who actually need services. Now we use the lowest estimates, and we compare those lowest estimates to the actual budget that's been allocated. Okay? So the costing team said that for the year for 2005 and 2006, we're supposed to need 5 billion rand just for the social development provinces across the departments, social development departments in the provinces, just 5 billion rand. But if you look at what's actually being allocated for the 2007-2008 year, it's only 1.2 billion. So we're already a 4 billion shortfall for the year that we're in now. So we're way behind on the budget allocations that we should be giving to children's social services.
All the nine provinces
for the social development department. So we're not looking at the big costing figure which involves education and justice.
Just children.
Yes, just children. Okay? So what has been allocated for this year, 2007 and 2008, is 1.2 billion. But we should have allocated at least 5 billion. Okay, for the third year, the costing report gives figures of 7.6 billion, again on the cheapest estimates. But the provinces have only budgeted in the MTF for 1.7 billion. So that's a difference of 6 billion. Now, if we actually start comparing actual MTF allocations with the more costly projections, which is your full cost high scenarios, which is based on actual numbers of children and actual needs, you're talking about 42 billion, for instance. I mean, 42 billion versus 1.7 billion is a huge difference. So what these figures show is that there's an enormous need for upscaling of services and budget allocations. Okay? But now these budget and service delivery, this growth cannot happen instantly overnight. And that's the reality. And so we have to face the reality that for the next 10 or 20 years, the government and civil society as a collective has a huge project ahead of it to actually upscale these services to the level that they should be. And while we're doing this, millions, and the number is millions, millions of children will suffer abuse, will be traumatized, will suffer grief, will be orphaned. And I think with that reality in mind, we have to think, how can we lay a solid foundation in the law to speed up the project so that we actually deliver faster and upscale that budget faster? Now, if you look at our history around something like the Child Support Grant, in 1998, only 300,000 children were receiving the Child Support Grant. Now in 2007, there's 8 million children getting the grant. And one of the reasons why that program grew at such a huge rate was that there was a legislative obligation to actually provide the grant. So the Minister of Social Development was obliged to provide the Child Support Grant, and children had an entitlement in the law. And that legislative obligation provides a foundation that can speed up delivery, speeds up budget allocation. So we need to think if we want to actually ensure that ECD improves greatly in the next 10 years, one way of doing that is putting a very clear foundation which says government is obliged to provide ECD. But that obligation flows through into all your budgeting processes. Dr. Mbeto was just telling me this morning that the target around ECD is at the moment we have 314,000 children in ECD. One of the targets is 2.8 million children, okay, under five, 2.8 million. Now, to reach that target from 314,000 to 2.8 million, one of the ways of reaching it faster is to place an obligation on the MECs, a compulsory obligation to provide ECD. If we leave it as a may, the MEC may provide ECD, reaching that target of 2.8 million is going to take double the amount of years to actually reach, if ever. Now, in the bill, the bill says that the MECs must provide protection services and must provide child and youth care centres, but they use the word may for ECD and may for prevention, and may for partial care and may for drop-in centres. So where we need to think carefully is whether we want to keep the may for all those other services or change it to a must. And the argument we're making here is if you want prevention services or ECD prioritized in the budget making, decision making process, you need to use a must. We wouldn't be asking this question if we're talking about schools or clinics. The South African Schools Act says that the MEC must provide schools. The Health Act says that the minister and the MECs must provide health services. They don't say may. So I think we need to consider why we're asking the question in relation to children's services. And if we look at the Constitution, children's rights actually should have greater protection than the rights of everyone. And some of the children's rights that the Children's Bill is addressing are not socioeconomic rights either, they're civil political. So children's rights to protection from abuse and neglect is what you call the baby right of everyone's right to freedom and security of the person, everyone's right to freedom from violence. And no one would ever say that the right to freedom from violence is a socioeconomic right. It's a civil political right. It's not subject to progressive realization within available resources. And the baby right is protection from abuse and neglect. So we can't subject services that are protecting children from abuse and neglect to the standard of progressive realization.
Do you have any court precedent to back that assertion, or is it your own interpretation of that?
It's an interpretation the courts have interpreted freedom and security of the person and the right to be free from violence as a civil and political right. So that is clearly civil and political. And if you look at the design of the Constitution, there are certain children's rights which mirror the adult rights but make it a sort of a basic entitlement. And protection from abuse and neglect is the mirror right for Section 12. As you'll see, children's rights to basic healthcare services is the mirror right of everyone's right to have access to healthcare services. So it has been interpreted that sometimes...
No, I'm asking the question because I know there have been constitutional court judgments relating to, for example, the right in Section 28 to right to a family and to alternative care if removed from the family. I think there is a specific judgment around that, especially in relation to inter-country adoption, possibly in relation to other aspects of alternative care. But I was just thinking, in relation to this specific area, could we possibly be having court judgments specifically talking in relation to children, not just generally in terms of this category of rights?
Okay, the one judgment I can
take you directly to is the Carl Michelle judgment, okay, which is not about children, but the Carl Michelle constitutional judgment basically said the state has a obligation to protect women from violence, especially if the perpetrator was already in the state system because the perpetrator was out on bail. And basically the state has a duty of care around protecting citizens, and that was around Section 12, the right to freedom from violence. So we could have cases. I just think it hasn't ever happened because children's cases, there's a lot less people litigating around children's cases. But if a child phones a hotline requesting a social worker to come and assist because they are suffering abuse at home, and the social worker doesn't come and the child is beaten and dies, you do actually have a case of wrongful death, a civil case against the state for negligence for not responding to that child's call for help. There are many cases. Childline has many on its books where it's actually received a call, has referred it to government, government doesn't arrive. Childline doesn't have the time for every case that happens to actually take a legal action, and most of the time the child who's been killed or has died at the hands of their parents, and so there's no one really to represent the child because the perpetrator's parents. So there is a clear cut legal case that could happen if the state doesn't actually ensure that those protection services are available.
I don't have a question in any way, but just something just crossed my mind to say. As the lady is stressing so very much, she brings me to an attention of something to me to say. Where do we find these children to say their first right is to respect other people's rights? The first right of a child is to respect everybody's right. That's my opinion. Two, when my child phones a child line, abuse, what, the child line interrogate to find out. You know, sometimes somebody pushes you to make a certain something, to act in a wrong way. Now, after the statement has been laid on the table, yes, this child has provoked me until at the long run I did this and this and that. How do you call this child to order? Or is it always good because it's a child? Then we have no society at the end of the day. How do they learn to respect themselves and other people? How do they learn to become responsible as children so that they must grow with that responsibility within them? Thank you.
Honorable Rabba, obviously the presentation is not finished, but I'm just...
That is what I was coming to check. Could we just have a point of order and that we finish the presentation and then have the question?
Yes.
Otherwise we'll be sitting here today, tomorrow, and a few more days.
Yes. No, I led this disorderly behavior myself and from the chair because I just wanted her to in her presentation to fill in certain areas. It's not really it was not intended to open up an engagement. But please proceed. Maybe let me lead by example and keep my mouth shut.
I think I'll actually lead in by, in a way, answering that question. It's very important that we need to change the way this bill is seen. This bill isn't about taking parents' rights away from children. This bill is about empowering families and communities and children and to protect children more. And what I'm talking about is that if we do not throw money into the prevention programs, into the programs to assist parents to care for their children, into ECD, we're not going to change anything. So I'm talking about that. I'm talking about parents' rights against the state. I'm talking about children's rights against the state. I'm not talking about the relationship between parents and children. I'm talking about the fact that children actually have, and parents have, a claim against the government for delivery of these services, because the Constitution says so. And if that improves, the entire family support system will improve and the relationship between parents and children can improve. So let me get back to my point. I'm going to talk about the budget decision-making process, because that's where we found the constitutional provisions that provide an argument around the must and may. Okay. Provinces get their their money 95% from the equitable share, which comes direct from National. They have very little of their own revenue raising. And when National Treasury decides how much to put into the equitable share for the provinces, they come up with a formula to determine how much gets given to the provinces. And in the Constitution, you have a section 214.2, which lists the number of factors that National Treasury must take into account when it drafts the formula. And one of these obligations, one of these factors it has to take into account is the obligations imposed on provinces by national legislation. Now, if you look at the current equitable share formula, it has about six components. Education and health are the largest components of the equitable share. And while the decision by National Treasury as to how much to allocate to each sector doesn't necessarily bind the provinces, what National Treasury says in the equitable share has a huge impact on how the provinces do determine their budgets. So there's very little deviation between the amount of money that National gives to a province for education and the amount that province actually allocates to education. Similarly for health. And the point I'm making here is that because children's social services do not have an explicit component in the equitable share, it doesn't flow through into your provincial government budget decision-making process. So what happens is that provinces will give money first to health and first to education. And if there's any left over after paying for the Gautrain or whatever else needs to pay at the provincial level, then they give it to children or children's services. Okay? Now, the Financial and Fiscal Commission has picked up on this problem. They're the body in the Constitution which is charged with safeguarding Section 214 factors. And they've recommended for Treasury for 2 years running now that they need to have an explicit component in the equitable share for social development services. And they're not just talking children, they're talking older persons bill, the Children's Act, services for people with disabilities. Because that, if that component isn't explicitly put in the equitable share, those services won't be allocated to the budget at a provincial level. Treasury has agreed with the Financial and Fiscal Commission that they need to do that. But they haven't yet done it. At the moment, Treasury is busy revising the whole formula for the equitable share, not just the social development component. And probably next year, this time, there might be a new formula for equitable share. Now, even though the Childcare Act currently imposes a number of obligations, the national law imposes a number of obligations which are borne by the provinces, it isn't costed in the equitable share. If we place very strong national obligations in this law, which is also agreed to by the NCOP, so it's passed all the constitutional requirements, the provinces are bound by those national obligations. They have to allocate money to those areas. Okay? But you've heard from Treasury, they are very, Treasury is quite frustrated that they've tried to tell social development to prioritize certain things like ECD, and then the provinces didn't allocate the money to ECD. And Treasury sends a what is called a provincial allocation letter to the provinces, trying to persuade them to prioritize certain areas. That allocation letter has no constitutional authority. The provinces are not obliged to listen to that letter. There's nothing in the Constitution which says they have to. But there is something in the Constitution which says that provinces and national have to listen to national obligations that are imposed by national legislation. So that is a mechanism that Parliament can use to actually guide budget decisions, is to place the obligation in the national law. And you will see that obligation being in the National Health Act, being in the Social Assistance Act, and being in the Schools Act influences more money being given to those areas by provinces. At the provincial level, now that's the equitable share. So if you can influence the equitable share and ensure that national allocates more money to the provinces, you've still got the problem that at the provincial level, the provinces make their own decisions as to what to do with that lump sum that they receive from Treasury. So the province decides how much to education, how much to health, and how much to children. And the provincial heads of social development have to bargain with all the other MECs. They have to put forward the business plans and they have to put forward the legislation that mandates them to deliver services. So if you give the MECs a tool by placing an obligation in the law which says the MEC must provide ECD, that allows the MEC to go to the provincial treasurer and argue for more money based on the fact that they've got a national obligation. So that it strengthens the bargaining power at both a national and a provincial level. I think that's the essence. It's quite a kind of a legal argument, so I try to set out as clearly as possible in the submission. But the essence of the argument is if you use the word must, it will influence the budgeting process at a national and a provincial level and will ensure that more money is allocated to ECD and prevention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. A lot of food for thought. I would imagine the members would agree with me. I just want to say that we ourselves as a committee have already identified, following the Treasury briefing which you alluded to, the need for us to have a very serious engagement with the department, with the minister, around the whole question of the readiness of provinces to really kickstart a massive revolution or massive expansion, turnaround, whatever creative word you can think of achieving this strategic policy, the goals of the strategic policy shift, which we keep on alluding to. We've taken out social grants out of the mandate of provinces, of provincial welfare departments, and located it in SASP, precisely because the intention was allow the space, the fiscal space, for welfare services to grow. Now, I'm yet to hear, and at some point we're going to have to ask Dr. Mavitra, together with her colleagues in welfare services. We had a presentation from the DDG beginning of the year on the welfare financing policy and the integrated welfare service delivery framework, which are supposed to be the core policy driver. Yeah, we need to get a sense of what are the big things that you people are working on at the level of coordination to ensure that we significantly grow this area and use this this gap, this capacity that has been unleashed as a result of removing social grants. But colleagues, this is the opportunity you are free to engage with this presentation. Any takers? Maybe let me kick start with this one. I understand you're saying legislation could be a tool. And we listened to Grahamstown yesterday, how they have had to use the courts to get officials to do their work and ensure that services are delivered. If provision in any case is already made in the legislation for certain services to be delivered, as this legislation seeks to do, doesn't that already create not only sufficient legal mandate, but actually sufficient legal obligation for the provinces to actually deliver the services? Because it's the tool of a mandamus if the government department is not implementing legislation. And if it's already in the legislation, whether it's a may or must, the court have interpreted the word may to mean must in particular circumstances anyway. So realistically in law, it doesn't seem to matter whether you use may or must. if the context suggests that the proper interpretation would be to use the word must, even where the word may have been used, the court will impose the must anyway. Can you comment on that? Are there any other questions? Yes, Ms. Sample, and then Ms. Dudley.
Thank you, Chief. Mine also around the may and the must, because the may to me seems to imply some sort of choice on behalf of the relevant MEC or the minister as to whether they could provide the service. And to me, I'm not a legal person, but the must is definitely stronger. But does the Children's Institute, I'm probably asking the wrong person, but does the Children's Institute have any idea why the drafter of this would have put in the may when it should be an obligatory kind of service?
I'm sort of, for me it's quite clear that a lot of the issues, a lot of the problems that we've been bringing up over the years are there because the may is there and it should be a must. But my thought is, and I'd like to ask you, and it links with this question, our assumption would be that the may is there because of the financial implications and that the departments would be concerned about the court cases. My thinking would be that, yeah, very definitely the must should be there so that it doesn't become court cases and that it's very clear that people must do what they need to do. However, I think that we're just naturally assuming that the may is there because of the caution. I would have even thought it was caution of Treasury, but now hearing, you know, what's being said, obviously Treasury are having their own difficulties getting their sort of allocations acknowledged. So if you could just comment around that and what how you see it negatively impacting on the services. If we've got this must and we've got no end of court cases and whatever those implications are.
Yeah, maybe you could just explain. We were told that there was, in fact, an allocation, for example, in relation to ECD. I think it's the year before last, which allocation ended up not finding its way into early childhood development services. I don't know how much knowledge you have about the dynamics there. But if we were to use it as a case study, what would you suggest are the learnings that we derived from that particular experience in relation to your contestation? Where do you think things could have gone wrong that the funds ended up not serving the purpose originally intended?
Keep going.
Okay.
Sorry.
Mine is around the allocation for chairperson. Not actually a question, but a concern of what is here on page 5 on the top paragraph. Wasted about 6.64 billion, 92 billion, and only 5.28. Maybe, Chairperson, if I'm analyzing the interpretation here, I'll be corrected with due respect. I take it for granted that I don't know whether this 60.64 billion was allocated for children only or input or for everybody, because the 5.28 billion says for social development department. Now, can there be an elaboration as to say, is this 92 billion education? There are so many types of education. We ourselves are still part of that education because we are doing some night schools somewhere, university levels somewhere, where we use schools of material and premises there. Now, can I maybe be clear to say, can we compare that? Is it possible that we compare that 5.2 with that 6, what, with 60, what, with that 92, what. Can you maybe elaborate as to say how do they tally? How do you compare them?
Okay, any further takers? Going on. Okay, your turn to respond.
Okay, I'll take that last question first because it's factual. The $60 billion for health is for everybody, all the health services that the health department provides for children, for women, for adults, for everybody. Okay, and the education, that's the entire education budget. That's schools, high schools and universities and adult education. The $5.2 billion.
Both the provincial and the national.
No, just provincial.
Just provinces.
I think
universities are national only. Are they also funded?
Some via, yeah.
Ah.
Well, this is just provinces. Okay, so we need to, whatever is funded is provinces.
Okay.
Then the $5.2 billion is not only for children, it's for old people and disabled as well. Okay? The particular...
And for everything else, I mean...
Not grants.
No, I'm excluding grants. I'm thinking something like community development, your poverty alleviation initiative.
Everything that social development does is grants. Okay? And the next paragraph shows you that within this $5.2 billion for social development, only $1.1 billion was for child care and protection services.
Including ECD?
That would include ECD.
And that was for last financial year?
2006 and 2007.
Where is the 2.something?
Okay, I'm going to talk to the ECD. We've been trying to figure that.
Get to that. You get to
get
that when you answer my question.
$50.6 billion. The very people who fall under this $5.2 billion again fall under the 60.04, if I'm not mistaken.
In relation to health, everybody.
And the very people who fall under this $5.2 billion are the very people again who come to us in that $92 billion.
Yes.
So I don't know. I'm not sure what I want to say. But the comparison has just driven me mad, you know, to say, can we really compare this with that and this with that? Because what makes me laugh is that the health allowance allocation was just 11 times, as more, 11 times. And to me, I should think it's not true. Because part of that money goes to those people with 5.28. And the health was 17 times, I mean the education was 17 times. Forgetting that the very people are served 10 times, because each and every allocation touches them. But they've got their own separate one alone. Those are the things that, when we say things, Chairperson, at times, we must take to consideration. As if now, somebody who is doing the allocation, say, maybe it's giving the children less money. Forgetting that the children are everywhere. Everywhere. Me as an older person, my grant is somewhere else. But still I fall under the health. Still I fall under the education. Because whatever I want to do regarding education, I'm going to use the state money somewhere, somehow, in an indirect way. Now, that is my concern, Chairperson, to say, maybe if it gets some more elaborated, I'll be able to understand. But at the moment, really, thank you, Chair.
No, I think that that's a very important argument that's being made. And we'll have to find a way, especially when we talk about comprehensive social protection. Because we must start moving towards a point where we begin to say, what is the total package? People talk of the social wage and so on and so on. So in that regard, at some point we may want to say, let's quantify the budget for every child in this country, taking into account the range of social services that go towards children. But I think that the argument that is being advanced in this context is to say, in that whole basket of services for children, social welfare services is one component. And that is the primary focus of this committee and this department. And the issue is, do we have a fairly reasonable allocation, which of course will grow over time, that would enable us to make sure that the numbers of children that need to be placed under foster care, there's enough capacity for services in that regard to be provided. Children that need to be in the secure care facilities that we talked about yesterday, and places of safety, which is a specific responsibility of social development. Do we have sufficient resources to make sure that those children access those services? So I think that that is the context in which this is thought to be put forward. But I think that the point that Umama is raising is an issue that we shouldn't forget. We should always have it at the back of our minds. We shouldn't lose focus on the total package approach in terms of addressing social exclusion. But please proceed.
What we've also done in this analysis is used a constitutional rights-based approach. So if children have a right to education, you then analyze the education budget to see how much is given to give effect to the right to education. Children have the right to health, you analyze the health budget. Children have the right to social services in Section 28.1c and the right to protection. So what we are doing is analyzing the budget that's been allocated to that right. We're not looking at educational health. And as an example, if a child goes to the health department and the nurse picks up that the child has been abused, if there's no budget allocated to social development to provide a social worker, health can't refer the child to social development for that case to be looked after. So health is quite separate to social services. They're two separate rights, they're two separate services, and government compartmentalizes it itself. That's why you have the two different departments. So you do need to analyze the budgets like this to actually see whether a particular right is being given effect to. But the package, it all makes the package. Without education, you don't have social development. Without social development, you don't have health. All of them have to fit together. And what everyone for a number of years has been talking about is that we don't, the package, the piece of the package that is being missing is social development services for children. That's the piece that's missing. We've got the schools, we've got the clinics, but we don't have proper social welfare services. And that's the link that we need to focus on. The question about what the reason is to why the lay and the mud. Now, in my discussions with Treasury and with the drafters is that it's for two reasons. The first is that there's a feeling that the Constitution only obliges government to provide protection services and alternative care, because there are two direct rights in the Constitution. The one is children have the right to protection from abuse and neglect, and that is an obligation borne by the state. Therefore, the state must provide protection services. Children have the right to alternative care in Section 28.1b. That's also an obligation borne by the state, because those are what you call wards of the state. So the state bears an obligation to fund children's homes. Okay, so therefore you've got the word must in the Child and Youth Care Centre chapter. When it comes to ECD or prevention services, there's an argument being put forward that the state is not obliged to provide ECD and prevention. It's something that the state would like to do because it will further the welfare of children, but the Constitution doesn't oblige it to. Okay, that's the one argument I've heard. Now, my counter to that argument is that that's just kind of a simple analysis of the words in the Constitution, because if you look at the right to protection from abuse and neglect in Section 28.1d, it comes directly from Article 19, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And Article 19 has clearly been interpreted by the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child to include an obligation on the state to prevent abuse. The state doesn't only have an obligation to protect the child after they've been abused and remove them to prevent further abuse. The state also bears an obligation to prevent the abuse from happening in the first place.
And the way we prevent abuse from happening in the first place is providing prevention and early intervention services to go into families who are showing risk and showing vulnerability to assist that family to stay strong so the child doesn't get abused. Similarly, Article 19 of the UN Convention has been interpreted to include an obligation on states to provide partial care in ECD. Because if children are in partial care in ECD, they are being supervised. They are not on the streets or at home staying with lodgers who can potentially abuse them. Okay? So they, at an international level, the UN Committee and international jurisprudence is very clear that if we want to give effect to the right to protect children, we need ECD and we need prevention services. Similarly, Section 28.1b says that, that children have the right to family care. In that same line, they say that children have the right to alternative care. The state also bears an obligation to support families, to enable families to give children family care. And again, that's your prevention services in ECD. And it does boil down to the budget and the money. And it's an indication of priority. So by choosing may and must, Treasury and Cabinet is saying we are going to prioritize protection services and children's homes. And if we've got any money left, we'll give it to ECD and prevention. Now, that might be a kind of prudent legal argument because it's much easier to litigate against government around protection and children's homes because the state does bear a clear constitutional obligation. But it's not a very good long-term plan because if you do not prevent abuse, your bill and the cost of the protection for children afterwards, because you're going to need more children's homes, you need more social workers, because the cost of an abused child is very, very, very expensive. The cost of early intervention in ECD is a lot cheaper than children's homes. If you look at the costing projections, they show you that children's homes is the biggest cost driver. It's the biggest part of the cost of this bill. They're very expensive to run. And if we do not try and prevent abuse and try and prevent children from becoming orphans,
You don't have to struggle so hard to convince us on that one. I think this mechanical interpretation of the Constitution is really a waste of time. The bottom line is that children must be protected. Simple. You see. And the only issue really is how do we ensure that in this legislation that is achieved. This legislation has already made it clear that prevention and early intervention is one of the core elements of the legislation. So we can now be talking about whether we may want to do it or not want to do it and all of those things. We've committed ourselves to that. That's the route we've taken in this legislation. It's clear. You know? I'm not going to enter into this whole fray around this belongs to me, that belongs to us. It's all part of one package, really. And all we need to do, I don't think there's any court that's going to sit there and do a head splitting and say, where a child has already been abused, then it's a must. But until the child is abused, then it's a nay. So I don't buy those kind of legal arguments, frankly. I think we need some degree of simplicity around it. Now, the big problem really is not about may or must. The big problem is the commitment on the part of those that and entrusted with this responsibility to actually deliver the service. And that's where we should focus our energies. How do we achieve this? And I don't think we need to be splitting heads over which component should be prioritized over which component. It's in relation to the same children who are in exactly the same set of circumstances. They're all vulnerable. So that really should be the way in which we approach this. Ms. Dudley?
In line with what you're saying and what we're basically asking, that you are clearly then saying that commitment is clearly going to be there if there's a must, and it's clearly not going to be there if there's a may.
I'm saying, even before you talk of mays and musts, that commitment is already there by virtue of the fact that this legislation talks about prevention services.
Yeah.
Why do we have it in the legislation if we're not really committed to implementing it in the first place? Then we shouldn't have it there at all.
Yeah, sorry, I need to clarify.
Yeah.
I'm talking in terms of our commitment, that's clear,
yeah.
In terms of the legislation.
I just wanted to
clarify. The commitment in terms of provinces and voters in charge of budgets and going down from there. I'm saying what I'm hearing then is that it's imperative that must is there if we could get that commitment further down the line, because May is just not going to bring that kind of commitment to it. Is that basically what we're hearing?
I'm no more on the 20th, and I'm moving forward to the service. Somewhere in page 7, the shepherdson, there's a big tool there for more vulnerable children with the reaches and child support grant is extended to 18. Now,
What is it in the license?
Wait.
She has presented her submission. I guess you are referring to her submission.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. May I please chair this meeting? Look, can I just chair the meeting?
I'll
clarify that. She has made her presentation finished. We opened up for questions on the entire presentation. Okay? We've had the first round. There's been follow-ups to it. We're having another round of questions. I'm not sure if she had finished answering all the other questions. It seems so.
Okay.
So you can ask any question on any page as long as it relates to this submission.
Okay.
And Madam Dudley, I don't know if that takes care of your question as well.
After matching that 18 on page 7, and then we turn to page 8 on the second paragraph where it says, in May 2000, there were less than 50,000 children in court ordered for sick care, blah, blah, blah. By May 2007, the number had reached 418,000, Up to now, Chairperson, we are saying these children must stay in those foster cares and what they up to the age of, 17?
18.
Okay. Now, Chair, what makes me to say this is the numbers that are there? Now, these 18-year-old people have got their own vulnerable children again. See? The very 18-year-olds have got children. And obviously because he or she is vulnerable, the child is also vulnerable. In other words, it means this country is just going to belong to vulnerable people. The budget of this country. Because we keep on... No. Before we make conclusions of these things, we must see to it whether we are falling into a pit or a clever man always goes around the pit. He doesn't follow that route because it was said you must go eastward. When you see a hole, you just shift a little bit and then cross again. Now, that's my point to say. We are saying from 12 years, the children must reach this and this and this and that because of this and this and that. Now, again, if the child is 12, 14, 16, 18, can get a child at any time. I write at home, it's not a vulnerable child, it's my child, stays at home, or it's either a vulnerable child somewhere. Are we saying this 12-year-old child? I'm very frightened here. There's somebody who is not supposed to come in here. Now, are we saying the 12-year-old
the mother. Maybe the father is also a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old, must get grants, both of them, plus their child. Which means it will be this 418,000 times 2, because it will be, or times 3 now, because it will be the mother, it will be the father, and it will be the child.
But remember, we're not talking of the child support grant.
I'm not talking of the grantee person. I'm speaking...
The foster care placement.
I'm speaking about the allocations that were named there, of saying that the education was given this, and the what was given that, and the what was given that. Now,
but the 418,000 that's mentioned here...
Is the number.
Is the number of children
that's
who were placed under foster care.
Is what I'm saying,
okay.
Now I'm saying it's going to be times 2 now. Times 3. It's going to be times 3 now.
The hope is that when the children are in foster care, they would be taken care of and brought up in a manner that would prevent them from being in situations such as where they end up having babies and those kind of issues. It's a particular intervention aimed at protecting the children. They are placed with an adult under social work supervision. That adult has to make sure that in raising those children complies with certain directives that were issued by the court, which placed that child in the care of that vulnerable child. So it would be the responsibility of the foster parent to make sure that all the values, all the proper upbringing that a parent is expected to give to a child is also given to this child who has been placed in the care of this person. So hopefully that child will not make babies whilst he's still under foster care. But that's just the hope.
For the very last, they're going to keep quiet for the rest of the meeting now. Now, Chair, we are saying, what the hell is it? We are saying these things from seeing them.
Yeah.
We don't just say these things.
Yeah.
We say it there, out there, we know these places, our families are there, our relatives are there. And I can make you an example that will really let everybody down. You know, my husband's a grandson has gone to a shopping center just because he doesn't want you to say take a room and sleep your own room where you sleep and get to the kitchen and wash your own dish where you eat from. See? He has decided to go to a dropping, to a foster care, at a home, something, or an orphanage out of himself. Now, there, they accommodated him. After a certain length of time, the other parents are going there, checking on their children. The child is vulnerable, but I can take food for the child. I can take clothes for the child. In a foster care.
When the child is supposed to be at home.
Well, now that child expects me
to support him
whilst he's in the foster care, in that center. You see, that is why I'm getting this question.
Yes.
Point number 2. I wonder if government or the social development itself is checking that, do they know how many of them are there? And because that very home that I'm talking about, it's a disaster more than anywhere.
So the question you're really asking is that, have we interrogated this sudden burgeoning of the number from 50,000 to 480,000? Can we explain that? I think we're going to ask the department to respond to that. And now that you've clarified that issue, we're actually going to ask the department to address us on that specific issue. But is there any issues that you want to respond to directly arising out of this follow-up question? We're still on the
floor. My mouth.
Okay.
Now, the thing is, what are these things of these centers? It's really making me very sensitive. I don't want to tell a lie. I become very, very sensitive when it comes to the number, to the monies, to the facilities, to the behavior of these children. These children, they are sniffing drugs right inside this home. Right inside this home. Because I'm just relaxed, a lot of clothes is coming, everything is just abundant, the food, the money is dropping in from every corner of the South Africa. I don't care for those children. It's what I saw with my own two eyes. Now, Shepherdson, when my child, like this child, because I took all the means and went to KZN to go and fetch this child, because it's my husband's daughter's child from his first marriage. And I thought it is because this child, these children grew up under neglect. I brought this child. 2 months was enough, his grandfather had to hit him, and I said, oh, doesn't go like that. When they get to this drop-in center, do you just accommodate them? Or do you find out first where the child comes from? What makes this child to leave the home? Or I'm just interested when the home gets full.
And do the programs at the homes make any difference?
Did they ever call? Because that very center that I'm talking about, I'm very used to that lady who cares for that center. And in fact, she's the one who is. She said, how come I did just buy clothes for him? You know, then I said to my husband, I'll never do that one. I can rather be arrested. I don't buy clothes for a child that does nothing. That child is in the street at 7 in the morning up to 7 in the evening. He goes to school when he wants. Can greet me when he wants.
So the point you really want to
find out.
Do they do their homework in terms of finding out where the child comes from? What were the
child comes from? What type of neglect or what type of an abuse was there?
Or they simply take the word of the child.
They simply take the word of the child.
Okay. I hear you. Okay. Okay. Sample.
Thanks, Chair. Are we still on the second round of questions? Because yes, I also was a bit confused about which part of the presentation
we're
on.
No, your entire presentation.
I'm not going on to the grant issue.
You raised any issue.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
You presented the full presentation.
I just summarized the budget issues, but the other parts, I'm happy to answer questions.
Yes, please. Okay. You're talking about adjusting the monetary value of the child support grant and the foster care grant. Was your thinking on that was to go somewhere in the middle of the two, or to increase the child support care grant, the foster care grant, or what was your thinking about that on the adjustment?
Any other questions?
And please remember, and this relates to all the presenters, that what is before us is the Children Amendment Bill. It's neither the Children's Act of 2005 or the Social Assistance Act. But to the extent that you have raised issues there, I mean, we can restrict you as to what you say, but as far as what we will take account of when we deliberate would be only issues that relate to the bill before us. But otherwise, feel free to respond, and then I'll ask the department if it wants to respond to any of the other issues that were raised. Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay, Honourable Member Dudley's question about the commitment. Yes, essentially our argument is that it's very clear this committee is committed. It's very clear that the national department is committed. But what we keep on hearing is that the provinces are not following the lead. So the argument is that if the national law is very clear on the commitment, so it uses the word must, then that obligation will trickle down easier. And I'll give you the example of a decision this committee made last year around the Children's Act, Section 42, which was around disability-friendly courts. Remember, there was an argument between the Minister of Justice and this committee, where the Minister of Justice came in and said, you can't place an obligation on the Department of Justice to provide disability-friendly courts. And in private conversation with one of the members, he said, the reason why you can't is we do not have the money. We don't have the money. And then the Member of Parliament said to him, but when will you have the money? We've been waiting 10 years now. And they had an argument about should the law lead or does the executive lead? Who makes the decision? And I think that's a crucial decision for this committee to decide. Is it Parliament's decision to place the obligation and to set the priority? or is it executive or treasury's decision? And my mechanical analysis of the constitution, as the commissioner talked about, comes from treasury, where they're saying they want to prioritize protection and child and youth care centers. But if this committee wants to prioritize the whole package, then my argument is used must.
So the interpretation that you've just given, it's not just the interpretation from the drafters that you suggested, but it's actually an interpretation of treasury that's been communicated to the drafters. Is that what you're trying to communicate to us?
I've heard it direct from treasury themselves and from the drafters, and I think maybe you can ask Cornell if he has the same.
I think the drafters will respond for themselves, because I'm not just interested in hearing what the drafters' own understanding of the legal imperative is. I want to understand whether the system has the same understanding. When I say the system, I'm talking about the whole system of government, whether not only understanding it that way, but it is designing itself and gearing itself that way, because that's a different issue. Okay. And then I hope that, in responding, Dr. Mabeka would also tell us. I'm actually curious to know how much of their time in the National Department do they spend it in Pretoria, as opposed to spending it in Durban and Free State and Cape Town and all over the country, because that's where the action is. You sit in Pretoria and you formulate this nice, beautiful nonsense standard. And then people in Pietermaritzburg look at this piece of paper and say, these people have the time to waste our time with all this paperwork, and they put it aside and do things their way anyway. Unless you're going to go to them and sit down with them, sit on their necks if possible. Let me say anything better. Unless you do that, you see, I mean, I don't see, because you see, last week somebody came from the provincial and local government, and they said we don't have chiefs to force municipalities to do things. You see, I don't want to entertain that kind of argument anymore. This thing of not having teeth, but people open their mouths, you see lots of teeth in their mouth, but they say they don't have teeth. Maybe we should define what teeth means, you know? Because you see, in life, the greatest power is not legal power, probably not even financial power. It's the power of the mind. It's the power of persuasion. That's the real power. You know, people are very quick to say, well, the act says, no, it's a may, it's not a must, so I don't have the power and all of that. I think that whole argument must be thrown out of the window. We have a unitary state. We have clear government policies. We have clear laws. All of us have to work collectively towards the achievement of that. And I can't see any official sitting in the province in the comfort of their seat and saying, well, you can't tell me anything because you have no power to tell me anything. You know, when the policies are very clear. Really. I think maybe some people are not interacting as closely as they should with certain people. And people are just throwing notes at people and then forgetting about them, and people look at those notes and say, hey, but Joella Gavina, let's say national, let's figure out talking about temporary. You know? You have to engage people, you have to persuade people, you have to move with the people if you really want to see a difference. And I really want the National Department to convince me that is what they are doing anyway. And if that's what they are doing, why are the departments not growing their budgets? Why are they, a situation is arising where Treasury has to intervene and ask provinces to ask for money from them? Where were they? Because that's the role, that's the facilitation the department is existing for. But anyway, I don't know if the department, did I see a hand? Just before they respond. Okay, let's first get Umama Weber, and then we'll come back to Magumeni.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Listening to all this, would it not be advisable for us to request that all the MECs or individually come and that we brief them on what is supposed to be happening? I mean, we did have Department of Local Government who seemed to not know what they were doing. Could we not arrange that the MECs be workshopped via the committee?
Look, I think I'm going to talk to the minister about this, and because I think that it needs to be centrally coordinated to look at how we can, because each has the MINMAC anyway, so that's where the coordination is supposed to happen, you know, and maybe if an opportunity arrives, I could even ask him to come to the committee at an opportune time to address us on some of these issues, because they seem to be quite challenging. But for now, I think we'll deal with the department officials because they are here.
Yeah.
And then we'll take it further at another level at another occasion. Ma, Gumede?
What is happening? Still on this number that is growing so tremendously. When any of us, my daughter or my son, has just decided to become a vulnerable child, okay, it's right, this is right. Now, thereafter, he or she, let me speak about the she, because the she brings everything home. The he can just run around the corner and leave. If she gets a child, automatically you'll find a two-day-old child in the in that center. What do you call it? That child has got parents. Did you consult Magunaide to say, Magunaide, don't you want this little child even if the mother is so useless? You know, the government is carrying burdens for people who afford to carry their own burdens due to some indirect circumstances. People who do these things, Jefferson, don't follow up where these children come from. If my child, like I have been saying, my grandson is there, if he gets a child, who said I don't want the child? Who said that? Because I'm growing old, I need a child. Should I go and adopt somebody's child somewhere whilst my child is cycling somewhere, adopted by somebody again somewhere? And yours again adopted by somebody somewhere, and she, just like that. It's no more so nice as the person who did this from the onset. It's now something, you know, something that I don't understand. Now,
can I just say something there before you finish? You see, one of the problems that we have is that some of these things are already structured nicely in the legislation itself. But when it comes to implementing, people give a wrong interpretation. I'll give you an example. You see, when we drafted the Social Assistance Act and we introduced the child support grant and we introduced the concept of a primary caregiver, what we said was that the person who is ultimately responsible for that child is the person that must get the grant. So we didn't say the first option should be given to the mother, and it's only if the mother is not interested to get the grant, then you can give it to the grant. We said we should look factually who is ultimately responsible for this child. If you are having a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old having a baby, and the mother of that 14-year-old is responsible for the care of that 14-year-old, obviously that mother, who is now the grandmother, is also responsible for that child's own child. And why should you then give the grant to this 14-year-old when you should actually be giving it to the grandmother? Because she's the one that's actually looking after the child, both of them effectively, you know. And that's where the notion, not of a caregiver, but of a primary caregiver came about. I don't know whether in practice the official actually interpret the law that way, or whether all this stuff here, we hear the stories about people taking the money and going to to do their hair with it and going to the shebeens and buying cigarettes and so on. How does that happen if they are themselves under the care of another adult who's actually the primary caregiver? So it's also a question. So maybe one of the oversight work that we're going to have to do in the foreseeable future is to zoom into the whole issue of how the law is being applied in practice by officials who have to implement this program. But I interrupted you because I wanted to bring that issue into what, link it to what you're saying. But yeah. Complete your point.
Let me complete my point, Chairperson. You see, Chair, just what you have been saying. You've got a 40-year-old daughter who has got a child, has departed with the father because the father is always not there. And just when she begins getting the grant, she'll be getting another boyfriend. The father of the child says he's eating my child's support. They kill each other for this support grant. I'm saying it from experience. I can take you to a home where this thing has happened. Exactly what you are saying. If the mother was the one receiving the grant for that 14-year-old child, that's for a 14-year-old mother. This thing wouldn't happen. That's point number one. Two, this 14-year-old, the 16th, after getting children, the poor mother takes them back to school. They don't go to school for 3 days as long as they are still having this one of grant. It will be a fight with the mother all along. She'll go to school only when the 200 grand is now finished. Again now, police come to make higher. I want this for school, Mama. I want this for school. That is the headache that we are getting. Who is supposed to monitor this whole process? Because we cannot keep on paying 795 and 300 million children are vulnerable. Whilst we are here to know the parents of those children. You see? It's not right, it's not right. So with due respect, can you just turn this issue into something else? Yes. Turn this issue of these numbers into something else and see if after 7 years we shouldn't have decreased this number.
No, I think the department will actually respond to those issues. We've taken care of the issues that need your response. I think now I'm going to... Yes. Oh, yeah. Just respond to that one outstanding issue, and then we'll get the department to respond. We're running things a little bit in an unconventional way today, but I'm just allowing the space because of the momentum, the prevailing momentum. I can quickly respond, and then we'll get the department to respond to the other issues.
Okay. The problem between the two grants is the difference in the amount. So your foster child grant is about 600 and something, and your child support grant is 200. And so if you were a granny or an aunt looking after a child, you would obviously prefer the foster child grant. Whereas, as Advocate Masuta has pointed out, the child support grant is actually designed for grannies and aunts as well. And what you'll also see is that in the rural areas, more of the grannies and aunts get the child support grant and less get the foster child grant. Within your urban areas, the foster child grant is more used by the grannies and aunts because in the rural areas, it's very hard to get a foster child grant because you need courts and social workers and are not there. So there's a bit of an equity going on a rural-urban basis as well. So the suggestion is that you should have one grant for the care of a child, whether you're a foster parent, whether you're a granny, whether you're the mother. And that you need to, therefore, bring these two amounts together. And the one way of doing that is you just put a cap on the foster child grant. You no longer increase it or adjust it every year for inflation. But you do that with the child support grant. And over 5 years, you can equalize. You cannot reduce the foster child grant. That's going to open up all sorts of constitutional challenges. So you have to
we must guard against the mechanical approach to some of these difficult policy issues. But I'll come back to that point. Let's get the department to respond to some of the issues that have arisen. Dr. Mavitra, well, maybe let's just start with Ronel on the technical issues of the May and month and where it comes from.
This was discussed with the state law advisors, and this point was also discussed when the bill was before the NCLC, and they, Dr. Mabeswa, can also maybe support me. And the question was asked because there was quite a thorough investigation on ECD especially, and because of the problem that in the provinces the budget is not, it's very often allocated, but it's very much spent. There was very serious interrogation onto whether one can have that as a must in ECD. But the problem was raised at the NCRC that if it's must, then it applies across the board. Then all ECD, all other country have to be funded, regardless of whether the parents can afford it or not. So the compromise that was reached was to leave it at a may. Look, it's clear that with child protection and with alternative care, no argument can be made that should be a may, because one can link it to the Constitution. With the others, it was not necessarily that we make it a may because the Constitution doesn't make it obligatory. With protection and with child and youth care centers, we said that because there's a link to the Constitution, it cannot be anything but a must. With ECD, with
documents... But what happens if they simply just don't spend the money on that whole function? As appears to be the impression we're getting here.
The discussion that we've had with the state law advisors and within the NCLT was that if you insert a must in ECD, and the point I'm trying to make on the mechanical interpretation of the Constitution is that in the case of child and youth care centers and in the case of child protection, you can link it to the Constitution, therefore it has to be a must. In the case of the other funding, you cannot simply use the Constitution and say it should be a must because it's provided for in the Constitution. There you need an additional argument whether the must should be a may, or, you know, whether it should be must or may. So there other things come into play. And when it was discussed, at one stage the department did have ECD as a must. That was a proposal from the department because of the fact that the budget is allocated but not spent. But then the point was raised in the NCRC that, but if it's now a must, then government will have to fund all ECD, even ECD of parents that can afford to fund the ECD of their children themselves, and that you don't want to impose that kind of obligation on government. Therefore, the may then was inserted in ECD, and we added that clause that said that in the allocation of funds, then, and I will read it to you, basically a disadvantaged families must be prioritized. That we're trying to put into, to sort of try and balance out the fact that we don't make it a must, it says that the funding of early childhood development programs, that's in 93, subclause 4, on page 14. The funding of early childhood development programs in communities where families lack the means of providing proper shelter, food and other basic necessities of life to their children must be prioritized. And then the other issue that was also raised is that social services and the provision of the Constitution in Schedule 4 and 5 also, there's a delineation between what the provinces should provide for and what national should deal with. And there's another problem there. One has to also look at that. And there was a feeling that national cannot necessarily prescribe to provinces how to spend their money. If it's something that's according to the Constitution a provincial function, then it's the province's responsibility to exercise that function, and national wouldn't be able to prescribe to the provinces how they should spend their money, because we even had discussions on whether it would be possible to maybe in budget allocation ring-fence particular amounts of money to be spent on particular purposes. So, you know, from the drafting side, I will draft whatever I'm told to draft, but these are just sort of the discussions that inform the eventual insertion of may in ECD. It's not only because of the Constitution, but it's because of all these other factors that will also add.
No, I think you can only take the point to a particular point from a legal point of view, and maybe the issue is not even the legal side of the issue. Maybe the problem lies elsewhere. Like I said, my interpretation anyway
of the law if one takes previous judgments on interpretation on this issue. The court can still impose a must in a situation where the legislation uses a may. So maybe it's not even a big issue after all. But Dr. Madhika, on the issues relating to coordination, you and any other issues? Yeah?
Is this on the point that the government would have to fund all ECD, including where they, for those people who actually can afford it? I'm just wondering if you could just explain to us how that actually works then in education, where government is not funding everybody's education, even those who can afford it. I mean, it doesn't sound... You know, just on hearing it, it doesn't sound like a solid enough argument. I'm just... with my limited knowledge, it seems like there's a lot of holes in that argument. I wondered if you...
Yeah, and if we're saying that the early years, 1 to 6, are the most foundational years of the development of a child, even in relation to education, then we go and weaken that foundation. How do we hope to build a solid house on a weak foundation? But I think those are the policy issues. Look, for now, I don't think we need to find solutions for the formulation of the clauses. Let's get to the bottom of the problem, and then we can look at how do we manage it in such a way that when we finalize the legislation, we arrive at a formulation that would be found to be reasonable for everybody. So for now, let's rather deal with the underlying policy issues and capacity issues. Okay, Dr. Madhika.
Okay. I'm just tempted to respond to this one.
You can respond to anything. Yeah. You are the chief director.
Provision for children, for especially school-going age children. And for the children between the ages 0 to school-going age. I think the fundamental principle here is that we believe that we need to support families, you know, parents, in order to raise their children within, you know, a family, you know, home-based, you know, situation, that parents have to be supported in order to raise their children in an optimal way. And hence, ECD with ECD...
I wish Magomeda was here to hear your response to some of her issues.
Yeah.
With
ECD, the first thing that we take into consideration is that, you know, it is a responsibility of parents to raise children, you know, especially when they're still very young, during those formative years, that the child really belongs in, you know, has to be raised within that family context. And that the state comes in where parents are unable to provide, you know, for the child. And as a result, we've been recently requested by Cabinetto craft a definition of a vulnerable child. What do you mean by vulnerable children? And I think the point of departure is that most children, we take that some children live in relatively stable environments, but all children are vulnerable because they need to be provided to them, you know, that their basic needs need to be provided for. But there are children whose rights are violated because all those rights are taken to the age of the Constitution, that the child has got a right to a name and nationality, family environment, not to be abused and so on. And that some of the children who live in a stable environment, family environment, those rights are well protected. But there are others whose rights are violated because of a number of circumstances, like children who've been orphaned, children who are abused, and so on. So our definition really would say, you know, I think even within the context of this legislation, we should be thinking of that when we think of the mass and the main, that who is our target? Is it all the children or is it the vulnerable children? The draft definition that we have here about, you know, children experiencing vulnerability, he's saying is a person who is under the age of 18, whose rights for survival, care, protection, or development is compromised due to a particular situation or circumstance. In addition, the vulnerability of sighted child is compounded by the inaccessibility of traditional safety nets, social services, developmental opportunities. That's where ECD comes in, and programs to address his or her basic developmental needs because of capability limitations, supply side constraints, or policy restrictions. And I think this, from the social development side, we say we want to ensure that all vulnerable children have got their rights are protected and have got access to services. And we utilize this definition. Yeah. And I just wanted to respond to that,
yeah.
That you know, the difference between ECD and access to education, that the state has got an obligation to ensure all children go to school, but with ECD is different because there's an understanding that, you know, the child has to be raised by parents at home. But if they're unable to, then the state has to take over.
So it's a discretionary thing for parents to decide whether to take a child to a crèche or not to take a child to a crèche.
Yeah, for example, there's no country in the world, even in socialist countries, that forces parents to take their children to ECD centers or facilities. But there could be somehow those that where the state thinks that there's a need could be influenced by other means to take their children to, you know, to ECD centers or to ECD services. What you are saying is also for those parents who are not willing to take their children.
But that's addressing one side of this coin.
We can do an outreach work. One model that we're doing is to do an outreach work.
But that's all of what you're saying relates to one side of the coin.
Yes.
And that is where you're saying you need to inculcate a particular culture and that requires a particular set of interventions in that regard.
Yeah.
The other side of the coin of this debate is a totally different question. And that question is, clearly government funding will be needed to drive that whole program. However way you structure it, whatever principles underpin it, but there will be financial implications. And unless there is an allocation, unless some money is spent in that regard, none of the things you're talking about would be realized or will materialize, at least insofar as government intervention is concerned. Now we have a situation, a case in point, where an actual allocation never found its way towards supporting that work that you have so elaborately explained. That is really the question. How do we make sure, as this committee, that in the way in which we couch the law, okay, exactly what you have been saying just now takes place by ensuring that the resources that have already been agreed to at certain levels are actually channeled towards. We're not saying this. We should couch this slot in such a way that it creates a legal obligation for certain policy programs to be implemented. We're saying where the policy programs are in place, where the allocation has already been done, how do we secure the actual implementation of that allocation? We're not asking for more allocation. We're not determining how much the allocation should be. We're not even determining how the allocation should be prioritized between the competing interests. We're just saying, once an allocation is made, how do we ensure that, given this experience, that allocation is actually spent for that which it was allocated. And maybe this even answers with the PFMA. We may be looking for answers in the wrong places. Maybe we need to be addressed on the PFMA in this regard. But Ms. Dudley, you've been burning to do a follow-up on that?
Tell me some of what you've said is really right.
Okay.
While you entertain as much reaction to the presentation, we should take cognizance of the other two presentations that you still have to be made. And not dwell. Let us pick up what is cardinal, and then move on.
were getting even close to vomiting this close group.
Okay. I think immediately after the finishing of this response, we're going to have a tea break, and then we're going to entertain the second presentation. The presenter, yeah, but the presenter, have we very much inconvenienced you? Who's the next presenter? Who is the second presenter? Do we have child welfare here? Did you have a choice? Actually, you had a choice. You could have raised a point of order. Please, if you feel that it's going to inconvenience you, in any case, we're almost done with this exercise. It was just a particular situation that developed. Okay, thanks. Anyway, Ms. Daphne?
Thank you. I had actually wanted to be pointed to the exact clauses and sections where that was relevant here in the CCD section, but you've explained to me now, so it's not as critical. I'll go back and find it myself. It's reassuring to know that that is the background. We're not looking to put this kind of onus on parents, but exactly what you've said. Can we not flag this and get back to us with exactly that? Because I think we need to spend a lot of time figuring out. We're talking about empowering the program and not putting some kind of handcuffs on the parents. So I think it's a good thing that we've heard this explanation because it clears it up in our mind. Thank you.
Okay, do you want to just finish your response? Then we'll have a quick tea break.
I was going to say you've
got to
put
your mic.
It's got a polygon ECD, an integrated ECD, and that's like a Bible in the sector, social sector. Yeah, we have to comply to that. We have recently requested the funding, that's 4.2 billion. It was not for ECD only. It was for other programs within the expanded public health program. And I think the provinces had taken it in a misunderstood that once federally allocated it, they have to also provide provincial treasuries with proposals to get that money. So some provinces did not do that, so they did not get the allocation. Well, the allocation was provided, but it was lower than which was initially expected by the officials. But this time treasury is doing it.
But there wasn't a situation of money going to the MEC for ECD and the money not being spent on ECD and being taken.
No, all the money has been spent. All the money that was allocated has been spent because the provinces, we are in a drive at the moment of registering sites. I know the things are not perfect, but we are registering extra sites and trying to get more children on the ECD system, especially children who are on the queue in those specific sites to receive subsidies. So every province is on a drive. We've got a plan of action at national, and then in the department we've got our own plan of action. Provinces have got a plan of action which they have to report on a quarterly basis. You know, this is part of the bigger picture of the program of action in the presidency, and we have to report to the presidency. And I was saying this year, this week, for example, we met with Treasury, with all the provinces who were there to bid for money for ECD. In fact, we are bidding for 7 billion rand in the next 3 years. But Treasury, of course, is concerned that are we ready to spend this money? Do we have the sufficient resources? The provinces have also bidded for human resources and operational costs because if we remember that, you know, ECD is one of the services that was not high on the agenda, you know, in the past few years because social grants was sort of more high on the agenda because it took almost 80% of the budget of the provinces. And it also took, when they moved away from the department, they took also the staff that was doing the work for welfare services. So we need to replenish not only human resources and finances, but the entire system has to be put in place. And we're saying this year and next year we'll try to have the human resources
to establish units at provincial level. All the provinces have agreed to that on condition that they receive the money. And we've got a monitoring system in place that will ensure that, you know, that happens. We've been to the provinces, Chair, to look at, you know, the ECD system. We have not been to all the provinces, but we know we meet regularly with the provinces. And if we get that money, we are targeting children. This we're talking about integrated, the basket of services. Not only with the welfare services as such, but with the social security as well. With ECD, we're targeting children who are on the child support grant. There are 2.8 million children on the child support grant between ages 0 to 4, but we are targeting 1.4, 50% to start with. And because we cannot say we can target all of them at once. And in relation to ECD. In that way, we will be dealing with what Honorable Mrs. Gunede has mentioned, that what we give these people money and we don't monitor. Through providing a service, ECD service to these children who are on child support grants. We'll also be checking what is happening at home. You know, with the training that the ECD practitioners are receiving, it's also to look into the circumstances of each child, the family circumstances, so that we can provide a service when it is needed. Because this is like double duty. You know, it's social security and it's the subsidy for ECD. So when the money is combined, it should really be of quite a lot of value to the child. You know, to ensure the proper development of that specific child. So that's the plan at the moment. And ECD being part of the expanded public works program, it reflects there's a priority of priorities in government. So we hope that for the next financial year we'll get that money and be able to move faster. So we can report on a regular basis to the portfolio committee. The provincial treasuries have also were there on Monday when we met with treasuries. I'm sure they're taking heed that they must, you know, allocate those funding as they were allocated by national treasuries for ECD. We've also had a bid for children's home, for secure care facilities and services to children who constitute the law, and also for social workers and for people with disabilities, services to people with disabilities. I know I've been requested to comment about the welfare financing model, service delivery model. This, together with a lot of questions that we asked, I think it is a good presentation from the department.
No, that's what I was going to
I've noted those things, and we could come at the next meeting. Maybe before we start, we could respond to this with a full presentation, because I've got gaps in some of the information, with regard to some of the information requested. I can just respond to the broken centers. That children who can live on the street, when they go to broken centers, we don't just give them food and let them go. We do interview them and find out, you know, where they come from, and where it's possible, we try to reintegrate them with their family. It's mostly in cases where there are no social workers, but even where they are cared for by voluntary workers, they still ask them questions to find out whether they can be reunited with their families. Okay.
No, I think you are correct. You see, what this helps is that there's been a lot of misconceptions of what is actually happening. And we've been getting snippets of information, treasury comes and say something that causes a lot of explosion and commotion and all of that, you know. So I think we do need a comprehensive official report or presentation from the department so that we're all clear as to what exactly are we doing, where is the problem, is there a problem, you know, what are the plans going forward. And in part responding to some of what is being said in all the submissions. So yes, we're going to have to schedule
you, I think the way we're going to do it is that once we've gone through all the submissions and we have a sense of what people are saying, we're going to give you an opportunity to respond and say, this is what people are saying. How do you respond to these issues? Yeah. Okay, we're going to have a short tea break. And again, thank you to Child Welfare for further indulging us. After indulging us yesterday, yeah, we owe you a big one. Let's have a quick break, and then we'll start with you. You have the advantage, of course, that you've had everybody else, and you can have the last one.
Sorry, there's going to be a brief input from the Gender Commission as well, but they've indicated they're going to be brief because they didn't confirm in good time that they were going to come to brief us. But we have a soft spot for constitutional bodies like the Gender Commission and the Human Rights Commission. So we tend to be a little bit flexible with them. Okay, let's have a short tea break and let's resume. Okay, thank you very much. We're proceeding to Child Welfare. It is your opportunity to shine. The second from the last word. Please proceed.
Director for Child Welfare South Africa for the Western and the Northern Cape. I'm actually standing in for Mr. Andrew Strong of our national office, who unfortunately cannot be here today. I don't know much what happened yesterday, luckily. I've just read in the newspaper and I was glad I missed corporal punishment, or what seems to me corporal punishment was the topic of yesterday. It is actually nice for Child Welfare South Africa to be part of such a discussion, and I'm sorry that we need to look at nitty-gritties and that we can't discuss the nice work that we actually do, that we need to concentrate on the children's role, because I think within social development and within the welfare field, a lot of good work is happening. Child Welfare South Africa is a national welfare organization. Funny enough, I did a bit of research on child welfare. It started in Cape Town after the SPCA started here. So 90 years ago, the offspring came from the SPCA. So people cared for animals, they went over looking, cared for children at the end. Before we go into different clauses of the bill, I think I just want to shortly mention to you that Child Welfare, our main mission is the protection of children. And our main interest is intervention and early intervention of families and children. Therefore, I will not continue on those clauses of putting in the must into the intervention ECD services, because we feel the same, that we have to put into the MSC for Social Development of a province must, from money appropriated by relevant provincial legislators, provide and fund prevention and early intervention programs for that province. Seeing that South Wales's main aim is the prevention of children and families, I just want to mention that we have national programs that we roll out throughout South Africa, and that is Asibabikele, that means Let's Protect Them. That's our HIV/AIDS program and home-based program. Then we do have Isola Bantwana, that is Eye on the Child, that is a 24-hour service, child protection services, and I think proudly we must say those two projects are really very active in all 9 provinces. Isola Bantwana, unfortunately, is very strong, the strongest in the Western and in the Northern Cape, because we started that and we rolled out Isola Bantwana within the Western Cape first, and then we went to Louisville where Baby Sitang were a problem a few years ago, and we started Isola Bantwana in Upington as well, and then with that province we were very fortunate they funded us to roll out Isola Bantwana throughout the whole of the Northern Cape. Tokomalo is also one of our safe home projects. That's where a lot of discussion goes around professional foster care. We don't talk about professional foster care within child welfare. We make use of our Tokomalo process. That's where we have caretakers and they look after 6 children that are in foster care in those houses, and we are sponsored by overseas sponsors for Tokomalo. And one of our biggest preventative services is our ECDs, our early childhood development programs. Our service centers, and you won't believe it, our welfare mission is working with children and families. We also take care of the elderly in the rural areas because of the lack of resources in our rural areas, and then after school care programs, and we are now looking at a safety network, a broader safety network in the communities for family and children. So we're talking about integrated services within our communities. Child welfare would like to mention in clause 106(1) that we would like the civil society to stay partners in our service delivery. So we would like to see that the clause 106(1), the minister must determine national norms and standards by regulations of the consultation with interested persons. We don't want interested persons to be mentioned in those clause because we feel the term is too broad, and interested persons within a specific sector, only for example government. It is essential that the importance of input by social society is openly acknowledged in the bill. So to remain in line with the strides already made by the SA government, we recommend that the clause will read, the minister must determine national norms and standards by regulations after consultation with the government sector and civil society. It is strongly felt that civil society must be included and mentioned specifically in the clause. The assumption that civil society would be involved in such process should not be made. Why we feel this way is child welfare's heartbeat is volunteers, and we only operate after having staffed the last number of volunteers are actually the people who are running child welfare on behalf of all of us. I'm actually not going to go through each and every page because then I must also stay here till 4 o'clock this afternoon. And unfortunately, I only came back at 10 last night. I would like to go and do some work in my office. I will then not discuss the phases seem to be 5 and 6, I will go over to child leaders' households, because I think that is one of the areas where we feel very strong that a child should, that's on page 8, a child should be allowed to stay a child. And we will actually, we recommend actually that we do not allow children to take over a parental role. Most of these children are over the age of 9, and as one of the members discussed earlier this morning, when they're 19 to 15, 16, these children also are very difficult. They need to find themselves. They need to be allowed to grow into adults. But if we allow them to become an adult at a very young age, we actually burden them with parental responsibilities that they cannot fulfill. We cannot expect from a child of 10, 11 to take care of the responsibilities of an adult. So we would like to see that clause 136 say a child over the age of 15 years has assumed the role of caretaker in respect of the children in the household. Child welfare feel very strongly that we don't need to take this child into the old way of allowing the children just to continue as is. We feel that we must do an investigation into the circumstances of the child, and that we will look into each and every child's individual situation. We also then ask the question, can a child who themselves is going through many changes accommodate the needs of their siblings? We put a financial burden onto these children's shoulders. Sometimes they need to find money for the household. They, through intervention, they do qualify for the child support grant. But the child support grant is not always enough to look after a child's needs. 200 rand is not enough money for a child to look after 2 or 3 other children. That's 600 rand per household. And that's why we send some of these children, and that's our expectation, of our finding that, especially in the rural areas where we work very closely with our children, that they are the ones to become the prostitutes, because they have to do something extra to be able to provide for the family. Therefore, we feel that we must allow a child to be a child, and we recommend that the age limit of 15 years as previously stated in this clause be maintained if we are to uphold the rights of children as stipulated in the Constitution. The reason why we say all of these is that's why child welfare took the initiative of starting processes like Asibabukele and Isolabantwana and Tokomalu, because within the community we are then trained the volunteers to take care of these children. And these children need the same services as all other adults. And within child welfare, Tokomalu and Asibabukele, we make sure that if there is a family where the children are younger than 15 years old, we actually do a proper investigation and place these children, if necessary, legally into the care of an adult. Because we believe that the children should have the right to continue their schooling and be able to grow up as a normal adult. On page 12, I've already said I'm not going to go into the prevention and early intervention services. From our side, we just feel that prevention and early intervention services must not be seen as a secondary service. We believe that is the beginning and the end of all. If we have strong prevention and early intervention services, that will reduce the need for more costly statutory intervention. We can actually, at a early intervention stage with integrated services, as was mentioned earlier already, prevent children and families to go deeper and deeper into the system where they will need all the money from SASSA at the end of the day. So that's why we say with the intervention services that we also feel that the services is a must and not a maybe. And I overheard this morning someone said there was not a lot of discussions yesterday about foster care. Child Welfare South Africa, we are struggling currently with our high number of caseloads, and if we do the research on our caseloads, we will see it's mostly our statutory responsibility towards our foster care placements. The foster care increase from 2004 to 2005 is 16%. We believe that we need to look at other alternative care processes. That's why I just want to mention again, that's why Isola Bantuan and Asababi Kele is part of our services in our societies, that we try and prevent our children to be placed into a foster care placement. We feel that foster care is still cheaper than placing a child in a children's home, but our main aim remains to keep a child within the family structure. But with the HIV/AIDS pandemic, it's not always possible to keep the children in that structure. Therefore, we believe that we need to look at foster care in a different way. We cannot continue with foster care in the traditional way as we were used to working in the old days, because a social worker like yesterday has been at Splittenburg Bay, and of a caseload of 180, 96 of those cases is foster care cases. And that is a statutory burden to a social worker. We don't have social workers to look after those cases all the time. Therefore, we from Child Welfare side really do believe that we need to look at other alternatives and not placing children all the time in foster care. There are nice programs like the Isibindis and our Asibabi Kele that we are looking at other ways and not always going the route of placing a child within foster care. It's not always possible to find foster parents for older children. Volunteers are always very willing to take on children younger into foster care. But I just want to mention an example of a little boy that was found in Solaris Park. I don't know whether you know where Solaris Park. It's an informal settlement to go up to Grabouw from Somerset West. A little black boy was found under his bed. His foster mother beaten him, and because he split it on his foster brother who broke into the school, he told his teacher, and obviously there was trouble, so his foster mother gave him more than a hiding. Child Welfare South Africa Helderberg tried to remove this little boy, and we are supposed to place a child within the area where they live. We just couldn't find, after 68 phone calls and 36 reports, we couldn't find the institution to place this child for safety, so that we could look for him, because his mother died, his father's whereabouts is unknown, and the only family member is the aunt who was his foster mother, who don't want to go back to his mom.
So we've placed the child nice now in our own children's home. And unfortunately we land up in trouble with the Department of Social Development who said this child should not be removed from the Somerset West area. So it's not always feasible to place children in the area where they live. We believe that the children must stay in the care of family, but it's not always feasible because our resources are also very full. And it is for a young child, we don't believe an institution is the best care. So we promote the court order kingship care for foster care. That's where we still do a children's court inquiry due to suspected abuse, neglect and exploitation of a child when a child is orphaned, and it can be shown that the child has no visible means of support. This could result in a legal placement with a family member and would require reunification services as well as supervision and monitoring. A distinction between foster care and court orders kingship care is drawn in order to establish differing administrative procedures in obtaining of a court order. What it means is that because of our high caseloads and because of the shortage of social workers, we want to promote that a social auxiliary worker will be able to do an investigation and go to court with a, and that means this is a straightforward foster care where there should not be problems. Kingship foster care for reasons for a child being offered could be investigated, processed and taken through court by social auxiliary workers. Social auxiliary workers would be required to co-sign, and the social worker will co-sign all reports but would not need to be present at the court. Social auxiliary workers would further assume the responsibility of monitoring and supervising all placements alternatively. Foster placements are always supervised by a social worker. The court order is mostly for 2 years, and we have a statutory obligation to be involved with this family. And being involved in two provinces, I can say this is the one service I think that the social workers fail in the most, because you don't have the time to do family reunification services. Therefore, we promote that we need to look at other alternatives so that the families and the children do get the services that they really need. And the other one is kingship foster care for reasons of a child being orphaned could be investigated and processed by social workers who complete the necessary report and submit it to court. No court hearing is held at which the social worker or family need to be present. The Commissioner of Child Welfare would review this report and make a necessary order. Any queries and concerns regarding the report can result in a court hearing being called. These options would reduce blockages at court, as well as social worker caseloads seeing the system to deal more effectively with children in difficult situations. It would also continue to allow for children who have been orphaned to receive foster care grants. Talking about foster care, Child Welfare South Africa's last remark is about child support grant and the foster parent grant. Foster parent grant $690 and a child support grant is R200. Child support grant is only for children up to the age of 14 years. A caregiver's responsibility and a child's need do not end at 14. And it might lead to dropout at school because the parents cannot afford to send the children to school anymore if they don't receive R200. R200 really makes a difference in someone's life if they don't have R200. But if that R200 has been taken away from them and there's no other means of income, that makes a big difference to a family's life. The parent system negatively impacts on the ability of children to complete schooling and opens children, especially those living in poverty, to exploitation and abuse. Secondly, the large gap in the amount awarded for foster care in comparison to that of the child support grant needs to be reduced. The present gap is an incentive for family members or orphan children to seek foster care placement, even in the event that the children concerned have been in their care for many years without difficulty. I just want to mention here, with experience in the field, I've been there myself for 17 years as well.
Excuse me, I think you're going to need to summarize and conclude. I know you are trying to give us a practical picture by giving all these examples, but the difficulty is that we have serious time constraints.
Okay, now I will be. I just want to mention in the different areas, messages don't get through from the department to our rural area. So sometimes children cannot be placed in foster care because some of the commissioners believe that children should not be placed legally in the care of family. That also creates a lot of problems within our service delivery. We then promote that the child support grant should be up to the age, extended to the age of 18. And the children can then remain in the care of the kin and assist a suitable child support grant. These matters would not be dealt with through the children's court. It can be postulated with a reduction in the amount of children receiving foster care grants with increase of the pool of funds available to our child support grants, allowing for an increase in this grant. More South African children, be they orphaned or not, could be reached through such a system.
Thank you very much. I'm not going to open for discussion. We're going to take the Gender Commission briefly. We're giving them only 5 minutes because we requested very late. And then we'll see if we can allocate a few minutes for one or two points of clarity, because we then have to adopt a program on how we're going to finalize this legislation today before we adjourn. Okay, please proceed, Gender Commission.
Thank you, the Honorable Chair and members of the Portfolio Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to address you. I'm Advocate Dani Rudra, the Parliamentary Officer at the Commission on Gender Equality. I will read the request or the reason for me being here today. First of all, I wish to convey the apologies of the Chair of the Commission on Gender Equality and members of the Commission who are unable to attend today. This is due to prior commitments. They are stuck in the plenary for the entire week in Johannesburg. The CG wishes to congratulate the Portfolio Committee on an excellent bill which seeks to protect the rights of the child. This, in our opinion, is necessary, and it is strongly supported by the Commission on Gender Equality. I want to place on record that as a Chapter 9 institution, the Commission on Gender Equality is committed to the promotion of an environment that supports respect for all human rights. And the perception created that the Commission on Gender Equality supports reasonable assessment, as indicated in the earlier submission, is incorrect. And the CG therefore wishes to unconditionally withdraw its previous submission in its entirety. Furthermore, in conclusion, the CG official position will be known once the commissioners have made input into the relevant submission. Thank you, Chair, and the honourable members of the committee. That's all I wish to say.
Obviously, that raises a lot of questions than answers. We're going to have to look at a way in which we interface with the CGE to sort this thing out, because as you correctly said, you are a Chapter 9 institution. We do not take what you say to us lightly. We haven't done so in the past, and we're not going to do that in the future. And if a submission is made to us that purports to convey a particular sentiment, and then it is then withdrawn, in the place of something else that's not before us,
Yeah, we're going to have to communicate further and see how we manage that going forward. But I'm limited at that. And suggest that if there are any other burning questions that people have in relation to the earlier presentation from child welfare, let's quickly deal with that and then get into the program. Are there any questions of clarity, Mr. Ashley?
What I really thought would have been useful for us is that there was a presentation yesterday by the NWSSDF, where they brought a possible approach to long-term, and it would have been interesting to find out if she agreed with that approach. And then they also had some very specific submissions.
What?
It's a possible approach to long-term kinship care for orphans and vulnerable children, but then they also have some immediate proposals that would be applicable to the bill we're dealing with now. And I just wanted her to give her an understanding of how these dovetailed or whether they were opposite or whatever. So, but other than that, no, thanks, I'm done.
Can I, is Ronald still here? Yeah. Could you just clarify the issue of the kinship care story once and for all? What is the legal position? Because the act has already been passed, it's in place.
The legal position is that...
Can you use your mic?
The legal position is that the Social Assistance Act, in terms of which these grants are paid, does not provide for a kinship care grant. It only is to provide for a child support grant, you know, in relation to children. It also has disability grants and whatever. But with regard to children, it provides for a child support grant and it provides for a foster care grant. So if we provide for a court-ordered placement in the Children's Act, there wouldn't be a corresponding grant to go along with it. So we can only provide for a foster care grant. And what we've done is we've said that a child can be placed in foster care with either a family member or a person who's not a family member, and to try and cut down on the administrative workload that goes along with foster care placement. We've made provision that a placement of a child with family members, the court could make an order that extends that placement up to the age of 18 years, and that there needn't be biannually follow-up reports and the matter referred back to the court every 2 years to try and cut down on that. But unfortunately, as long as the Social Assistance Act does not make provision for court-ordered kinship care grants, we cannot, in the Children's Act, provide for court-ordered kinship care placement. That's the reason why we had to remove any reference to court-ordered kinship care from the Children's Act, because the Social Assistance Act doesn't make that provision.
I support your assertion, but for different reasons. As far as I'm concerned, kinship placement from a social security perspective has indirectly already been provided for, because the child support grant is accessible to a primary caregiver, which includes any form of possible relative of the child that you could possibly think of. The only issue is the 14-year limit as opposed to the 18-year limit. So in that sense, it's already been catered for. So the only, I really don't know what the issue is. In fact, I think by introducing the notion of a long-term foster care placement, to paraphrase what you're saying, maybe you have created a new challenge of interpretation. Placing long-term placement with a relative, that's where the contradiction between that and the child support grant is going to be further accentuated. But I'm not going to open a discussion on that issue. When we deal with the bill, we will possibly come back to some of these issues. But to the extent that it's already dealt with in the Act that we've passed, and it's dealt with in the Social Assistance Act, it might be a matter that doesn't even arise before us as we speak. All right. I think we're going to leave matters there. Let's look at the program quickly so that everybody has a sense of the way forward and people can plan their diaries in advance. Now, we have a draft program. I don't know if... That's the other paramount issue that is bedeviling this thing. But we're going to go back to this issue at an appropriate time and possibly bring Social Security here as well. All right. And as you recall earlier, we agreed that the department is going to come back to us with a more fuller briefing on exactly what's happening with this provincial capacity and budgeting and allocation and all those issues at a later stage. Right. We are on the 19th of September, which is today. We have completed the process of public hearings today. The next step that necessarily has to be followed is to consider all the submissions written and oral that we have received to date, and in the light of that, look at whether there is any need for us to effect any adjustments to the bill as it came from the NCOP. Once we have concluded that process, and of course in doing so, we would also have to look at whether we need any further input. Already we've identified the need to get a further briefing from the department. Whether we need any further input from the department or from any other person before we then give instructions to the draft if there's a need for any adjustment to the legislation. Then they'll have to come back with a redrafted bill, that is if there is a need for amendments. And if we're happy with the redraft, we would then consider the bill clause by clause and pass it. So that is in essence what we target. After we've passed it, it goes to the National Assembly, of course, and after it's passed there, it goes back to the NCOP, which also runs its own process, and we'll come to that point. But if there's no consensus between the two houses, it would have to go to mediation. So all of those processes would need to be factored into this program. Let me state that our target is to finish this bill before Parliament rises in November, and I'll explain why this is an imperative. It is necessary that the legislation is ready for implementation by the 1st of April next year, because that is the last financial year of this current Parliament. If that doesn't happen, then we may forget about seeing the new children's law that we've worked so hard for and sweated so much, you know, becoming a reality during our parliamentary life, because we don't know if we will come back after 2009. Sorry? So we would like to leave you with a present. Which is not only a car that has never been driven, but a car that can fill up the children and take them somewhere, and you can actually watch them get there before you decide whether you're coming back in 2009 or not. Right. So that is the time frame within which we're going to. Now, to achieve that, it means Come the 17th of October, we must on that day formally consider the bill with amendments, if any, that would have already been effected by the drafters, and vote on the report on that day. So it's D-Day, the 17th of October. Then, on the, and that would have meant that between the 12th and the 18th of October, the state law advisors would have verified the bill and with amendments, and also South African law, what? SLA, what's that? The state law advisors would have met with the LNP, that is the people who deal with the process in Parliament of finalizing the text and so on, would have taken place. Then the 25th of October, we can then have a debate on the bill in the House. And then, of course, once we pass it, it goes over to the NCOP. I'm not going to deal with the NCOP process, except to say that would mean we would be leaving 3 weeks for the NCOP to finalize the bill from their side. We cut down their time considerably. The usual cycle is 6 weeks for them. But when they're considering amendments from the NA, we are arguing, they don't need to, the provinces don't need to go and get fresh mandates and have public hearings. They just need to confirm, you know, those mandates with the NCOP. So that process of confirmation, we're allowing 3 weeks, including the passing of the bill by the NCOP. That's how we propose. Now, to achieve that, we have today, as our last sitting day before we go on recess. When is recess ending? When are we due to return after recess? 8th of October. Sorry? Is it the 15th of October? Now the difficulty that we are having, and this is a serious question, between today and the 17th of October, when we'll be considering the bill finally, all the other processes I mentioned needs to have happened. We need to have looked at this submission in relation to the bill, written and oral. The drafters need to have gone back on our instructions and done the drafting and come back to us with final text that we then must then by the 17th of October adopt finally. And in between, of course, parties would have had their own brief, their own caucuses, have their own internal study groups, whether they joined study groups and all of those things. Now, this is where I'm going to plead with my members. I know this committee has been a very busy committee. We have a challenge here. If we are going to complete this legislation by the 17th of October, obviously we can't sit and do nothing and wait for the 17th of October and then come here and then pass the bill. It's simply out of the question. There is work that is going to have to be done between today and the 17th of October. So I'm trying to find the most diplomatic and motivational way to talk to my members. Because I know a lot of sacrifices have already been made. People have been really pushed to the limit.
The proposal is that next week is a constituency week. We keep it clear. People go and interact with their constituencies and so on. The proposal further is that we request only 1 week out of your constituency period. And that would be the second week, the week after next, for us to come back here and do all of that work finished. And then give it back to these people to go and draft. If we can't set aside that, just that 1 week, then we won't meet this deadline. So, the suggestion is that we take, if we can't take the full 4 days of that week, at least we take 3 full days out of that week. We could possibly say Tuesday to Thursday. Sit down, go through everything, sort it out, agree, this is the route to go. And then we leave it to the drafters. And that would be the week following when the draft is. We're saying the week of the 2nd to the 5th would be our deliberating on the bill. And then the week of, where have we got? Now, sorry, Lana, can you just assist me there? Just explain the point between the 2nd of the 2nd to the 5th that week. Possibly we could be talking the 2nd to the 4th. And between that and the 17th of October. Just that. But if you could, just assist me how we are proposing to finalize the budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The purpose is for the committee to identify the amount of time it's going to need to meet. And like you said, we can decide on either 3 days or 4 days, the 2nd to the 5th of October, or that would be, if I look at a calendar, it will be on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Or the 2nd to the Tuesday. Okay, so the 2nd to the Tuesday.
Either Tuesday to Thursday or Tuesday to Friday, that's in essence what that means. Okay, fine.
Okay, I just want to raise another point that leads on to what you've said earlier about meeting, about the interface issues on the budget and addressing the minister and things like this. So if you want to meet 3 days, so you can meet Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, and if you request the minister, you can, at the MINMEC meeting, when the minister meets his MEC, it will actually be an opportunity for the chair of the committee to, you know, report on the bill and get the buy-in from the MECs on the provinces as to the way it goes forward. So that opens you as chair if you want to take that route. But it's up to the committee to decide on those 2 days, on a 3-day week or on a 4-day week. And then when Parliament then officially resumes on Monday the 8th, that entire week has been set aside by the National Assembly Programming Committee for committee work, ultimately, and there are no plenary scheduled in that week. So, with permission, we can get a lot of structured time and have full-day meetings to resolve these issues, and the departmental team and the legal drafters and the state law advisors will all be part of this process. We may even find, as we go through the deliberations, that you want to meet in the morning and allow the officials time to go back in the afternoon to draft and come back. But if we can have if we can go through the clause by clause deliberations at that week and consider the public input, and that's ultimately that takes us up to the 12th. So that will allow time for the state law advisors to scrutinize the bill and the amendments between the 12th and the 17th of October, where the committee will then formally consider the bill on the 17th of October. Thank you.
Can I suggest that it seems as if we would effectively have 2 weeks to do this week?
to do this work. The 1 week would be stealing a week out of the recess period, maybe 3 days, say a Tuesday to a Thursday. And as a faith, focus on chewing through what we have received from whatever source. Okay? If we need to get further input from any other source like the department, we would need to squeeze in a slot during that week. So we consider all the written submissions, we take account of everything that's been sent to us from anywhere, and then we engage on those issues as we proceed through the bill. And the tool that we would then use there would be the summary that the research unit did for us. All we will need is that at that point, the oral submissions that we got from the provinces that we have not yet been summarized into this documentation before us, that is integrated as well into that discussion document as well, that summary from the research unit, that we move from one page, we move from the same document, everything that we need to take account of is there. We go through the submission during that first week. We get any briefings from the department if we have the time to do so during that week. Then the following week, we then consider the bill itself and expressing our views on the different clauses. Okay? That would be the week of the 8th, okay? Right? We finish the bill during that week. And we allow by that Thursday, what date will it be? The week of the 8th. Yeah. We allow from that date to the 17th space for the final drafting on the part of the state law advisor. And of course, and then the draft must actually be circulated beforehand so that members come into the meeting having looked at the draft and having made up their minds on whether they're happy with the content that's captured by the state law advisors, or if there are problems, when we come, we can just clean up those issues. But come the 17th, that's the date on which we are passing the bill as the committee. That's generally the structure that's being proposed here. Lana, in that summary, have I left anything in your view? That is the committee process.
No, Chair, but I stand to be corrected if I missed something by the committee section or the state law advisor.
Okay. Right. State law advisor, you are here. I'm going to ask your input as well on this so that everybody has a bite in here. Ms. Sample, do you have an input?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. And please rule me out of order because if next week, because I'm not always completely sure about these things. But isn't it strange for us to be deliberating the bill and voting on it on a Wednesday? Don't we normally just have questions and then that's it? We don't normally discuss bills on a Wednesday, but I mean, I'm not in programming, so I don't really know.
You're talking about the National Assembly process? Now, let's not worry too much about the scheduling in the National Assembly. Let's focus more on our process with our deadline being the 17th of October and pushing for that. Ms. Dudley?
Just to ask whether the summarized documents that we're talking about would include any submissions that came yesterday that perhaps hadn't already come through the provincial hearing. So,
what happened yesterday is this. People have been invited to forward written submissions. Now, yesterday they were invited to talk to those written submissions. So effectively, whatever was said yesterday is not a departure from what they have provided us in writing. And if there is any contradiction between the two, the written form would take precedence. Mm.
And then will that be ready for us on the 2nd?
All of that is already there.
So
complete.
All those submissions that were talked to yesterday are already with us.
But not, I'm saying that the summarized documents, so will they be complete?
The summarized documents come next week. This week already. Let me ask the researcher to talk to. How soon do we have? Remember, let me just report on something else. The oral submissions that were not written that we got from ordinary people as we're moving around the country. The committee section has written a summary report that seeks to capture the essence of what we got out of that interpreter. The department, LANA basically, has her own summary of what he captured there. Okay. On top of that, we have all those tapes consolidated into a single CD that is now going to be transcribed at a cost all in all of about 33,000 as the official record transcript of everything that was said there. So we have this sources of information in that regard. We're saying that this, for the purposes of this committee, we want to work with one document that we can all work with. The ideal would be, firstly, that information coming from that source must be integrated into this research unit document that is our working document. That's one. But two, we've said the committee secretary's report is the official report for us with regard to the proceedings that took place in those processes. So she must look at what she's got against the background of what the department captured, against the background of what the transcripts will reflect. And her final product would be a report on the hearing that she will provide to the committee as an additional document. But the research unit would integrate aspects of that that they find relevant to specific areas of the consolidated document that they've given us. They'll factor those things in there. So that when we consider the submission, everything relating to the submissions has been summarized or in some way, you know, factored into that particular document. Well, is that sufficiently clear? And then, of course, I'll ask the researcher to comment in this regard if there's anything that I haven't accurately reflected. Yeah?
You know, obviously, we're largely concerned about the proposals being where we can refer to them easily. That's what we want.
Yes, yes. And of course, if you don't agree with the summary of the researchers, you would have this other document. And you are not restricted to that summary. If you find this bundle, that is a point that you think the summary is not covering, then you can raise it, no problem. Okay? Or in the transcript. Okay? Every piece of document that is before the committee is before the committee, and the committee has the right to allude to anything said in any piece of document to advance whatever argument that they want to put forward. Okay? Right. And just for the public, because there's been this problem, the following is the position. All documents that are put before the committee are public documents, which means if people want to access information that has been forwarded to us, we cannot refuse them access to that information. Okay? We do not have an obligation to be making photocopies for every one of the 45 million South Africans who may want a copy of what we have. If there's an arrangement that can be made for people to be able to access whatever document they want to access and make copies for themselves, if that is logistically practicable and reasonable, that should be made possible from the committee section. But we do not have an obligation to make copies for people. What we do not have an obligation to provide is what then becomes the summaries that the research unit does for us to enable us to plow through this work, you see. Because I don't want people later saying, no, but the research unit did not accurately capture what this submission or that submission said. They don't have to do that. And it's up to us to decide whether they did or didn't. Because after all of us have access to the original documents. So we have no reason to complain. Okay. It's just a tool to assist us, an internal instrument. It's not a public document. Nobody other than a member of parliament has the right to demand it. Okay. Right. So I hope that clarifies everything. Everybody's on board. Let's all go next week and tighten our shoe laces. Yeah.
Do we have any idea when we can have the final summary?
Yeah, I was going to allow the researcher to have a final word before I adjourn the meeting. Researcher, you want to comment in the light of everything up there?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to indicate that last week I made a draft available to the members of the summary, but the last was 2 weeks back, and I received other about 10 copies of submissions. So I have a second draft which is ready for circulation. I just have to give it to Zola to make it ready for the members, which incorporates all the submissions I received last week. So that second draft is ready for the members to have.
And that includes the submissions that we're collecting along the way as we're moving around. Oh, so that's already integrated anyway.
Yes, I'm just saying I have, from going through the submissions, I realized some were the ones that you're referring to, Chair, that were handwritten, some of them from the public hearings that you held. Others are the ones that were forwarded to Zola by either by fax or by email. And also the ones that the Children Institute submitted last week by email to me. So the report that I have all the submissions there.
Thanks. So that's it. All written submissions captured in the summary. If there's anything that you think has not been captured, you have the original text. You can always raise issues arising out of it. That's where the matter is settled. As far as the oral submissions from outlets that we got, the transcript story is going to take care of that. And as soon as the information is ready, the research unit would look at how to integrate that information into the summary as well. When we get here to start working, come next week after next, the hope is that all of that work shall be ready for us to do. I think that the push is for 3 days at this stage, which is second till the fourth, Tuesday till Thursday, week after next. So you have a break of a week there. Yes, I sincerely apologize for the inconvenience that are causing to colleagues. But let's all do all the sacrifices in the spirit of the children.
Definitely, if I don't hear of the children's birthday or the rest of my life will be short, I will
We hope after November this year, nobody will hear of amendments to the children's book. Okay, thank you very much for everybody's cooperation. We understand our lunch is again not in the so fancy restaurant. It's next door. Soul food. So, welcome to lunch. Thank you very much. Next door. Thank you.
This one is just about the
Ma? It boils down.